being unique.
Until somebody asks you and you start reflecting, and I'm always so sorry that I never got some of the things I thought I did on tape, but I just...
Yeah.
Did you feel like you were deprived of being in a small town as living as opposed to living in Pittsburgh where you could go to the museum?
Yeah, we did. I think there was a certain amount of that. Yes, we were a little bit, shall I say, envious of our big city friends who did have, you know, some advantage. We did feel, I always felt a little bit like a country bumpkin, truthfully.
Really?
Yeah, sure. I don't know anymore, but at that time of my life, I really did. They were, they led a far more sophisticated life, and when I went into Pittsburgh, and these, you know, these kids did a lot of things that we didn't do. They did go to museums, and they did do, they didn't have to go to Hebrew school, and most, a lot of them didn't. Or if they did, they went to a couple days a week, and yeah, it was just a different kind, totally different. And there was a... being Jewish, there were Reform in Pittsburgh, and there were other kinds. Well, there was only one kind in Butler, although there were people who would call themselves Reformed and so forth, but the structure of the synagogue really dictated the... That's right.
You, the boys all went to Penn State?
No. Three of us went to Penn State. My brother Sid, myself, and Lewis went to Penn State. My brother Norman went to undergraduate at Dickinson and to law school at Dickinson. And my brother Richard went to the University of North Carolina and the University of Pittsburgh. And my sister went to Goucher.
What does Sidney do now?
He's retired. Lives. And he lives in Boca. What did he do? Yes, we were, my brother and I were in business together. Two of my brothers, my brother Lewis and I and Sydney were equal partners in retail business for over 30 years.
And I'm assuming that Beulah?
Beulah was married and mother, and then she went into business with her husband in Penn State, as a matter of fact, right. Until she retired. My brother Norm is an attorney, and Richard was, until very recently, the director of Job Corps for the United States.
It's a very large job.
I don't know.
He just retired from the government at age 50, because you can retire after, he was 25 years in the government. He had been an Air Corps officer, and then he went into the government and eventually became Director of Job Corps for the United States of America. And then he's retired. Now he's a consultant to RCA. That's what happens to...
Uh-huh.
To the company they were dealing with before.
They asked us a little bit about your school days, and I think we covered that very nicely.
It didn't bother me.
I'd like to know a little bit about your teachers and classroom discipline and that sort of thing.
No, I went to it. First school I went to was the Jefferson Street School, and all the teachers were women.
All of them?
All the teachers were women in the grammar school. Not until you got to junior high school did you see a male teacher.
And you really remember that?
Oh, absolutely. My school rooms that I went to, believe it or not, in Butler had pot-bellied stoves in the rooms. And part of the fascination going to school was to the pot-bellied stove. That's what put coal in there and wood. That's the way I went to school in Butler, Pennsylvania. And after the first 5 or 6 grades, until I got to the junior high school level. And then you went into
a... Would this have been like a one-room school?
No. It was an old school. It was 3 stories, and it had wooden stairs, and the first grade was on the first floor, and the first 2 grades maybe on the first floor, and they might have 4 or 5 rooms on the first floor, and the second floor would have another 4 or 5 rooms, and they had a bell. That's how you knew what time it was to go to school. They actually rang bells. It's true. true. In my lifetime.
But it sounds like a terrible fire trap.
It was a terrible fire trap. It would never in a million years today allow that school to exist.
Can you imagine what could have happened?
And that Christmas trees. We had the fire escapes. No, you had a we had the fire drills, and you go down the fire escapes and so forth. Mm-hmm. I know. You know, that's the way schools were in Butler until almost the Second World War. And then there was a whole new building program going, because there hadn't been anything built, and then the Depression came along. They certainly weren't going to build schools in the Depression. So it was not until about the Second World War that new buildings were put up, and the old ones, that school I went to was fortunately torn down, excepting the one schoolroom schoolhouse next to it, the Little Red Schoolhouse, which they've kept as a landmark, because that was the first school in Butler. Still there. The landmark.
You mentioned the Depression. What memories do you, how did it affect you? Because you can remember it.
Oh, I can remember the Depression.
I'm sure you can.
Very clearly. Well, what I remember most about the Depression, and I've never forgotten this, were grown men coming to our back door of our house and asking for a meal, and what could they do for a meal? Asking my mother, can I clean out the furnace, because we had coal. We did not get gas until the late 20s, maybe 1928 or 29. We converted ours to gas, you know, until that time. We had a coal down, and I used to help take the ashes and put them in the garage so they could be hauled away. But they would, grown men, come to the back door, and what could they do? Could they rake the leaves? Could they do something around the house or something to fix? I still get a lump in my throat when I think about it. There's a man. We never turned my mother, never turned a man away. But that's what I remember about the Depression. I was bar mitzvah in 1934. My mother died in 33, in October 33. In May or April or May of 34, I was bar mitzvah. That was the bottom, you're talking about the bottom of the Depression. And you just knew people were suffering around the community. In a small community, there weren't too many affluent sections. Everybody's mixed together. There wasn't a Jewish section. I said we didn't live it because it didn't exist. There was a Jewish section, but it was like one street in one side of the town. That was where the butcher shop was and the shul was. And that was two streets, 4th and 5th Avenue. Whatever Jewish section there was, that was it. And so it was true of economic situation. It wasn't, you know, people mixed a lot, were mixed. In a small town, a lot better. You did have poor people living around the corner from you, and two blocks away could be poor people. We personally never suffered. My father's business suffered during the Depression, but he had made a lot of money, and he was able to weather the Depression, and none of us really felt very much about it. Besides which, life was much more frugal in those days. You know, just the whole style of living. I mean, people didn't have two cars. If a family had a car, that was it. And there was no television. And if you had a radio, that was the center of the household. Just to have, I remember my first radio was a crystal set. I was so excited. Bingo. Bingo. That was what you did for entertainment in the bingo night at the theater. They used to have these special, you know, go to the movies. The movies was the big thing that you went to.
Now they have the bingo at the temple.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They
had
to make money somehow.
Yeah.
In other words, it was a much more cohesive community.
Oh, sure.
People were much more concerned about one another.
Yes, you really did help one another in these small towns that you couldn't. The poor people weren't in one section, you couldn't see them, you saw them. and you'd go to school, and you didn't go to a school. The Jefferson Street School had every kind of kid in it. It wasn't like, say, Taylor Alderdice, where you might have a middle-income group and then maybe an upper-middle-income group, but you might not have too many poor people in there. But plenty of poor in these schools. And you saw these kids coming, and you knew that you could tell by the clothes they wore and the shoes that weren't in good shape. And
what kind of health and medical care did you have in those days? Was there a hospital?
Mm-hmm. But we were born at home.
Really?
Mm-hmm. I was born at home.
Doctors made house calls or midwives?
I was not born in a hospital. The next three, the younger ones, they were all born in hospitals. I was not, and my older brother and sister, because women didn't have,
Go to the hospital.
I was born in the bedroom upstairs, you know. I don't know which room it was in.
Was there any trouble getting the doctors to come to Butler in those days?
No.
You were happy to be in a small town kind of a situation.
No problem at all.
What
family? You had a family doctor, and you inherited him, as a matter of fact.
He just kept going down the line.
Sure.
We had vaccinations then. Did we have diphtheria?
Sure. You had to get them when you went to school if you didn't. Yeah.
There's a little question here that Muriel asked you a little bit about it. They'd like to know what you did in your adolescent years for fun and recreation. Now, that has to be beside
you. Oh, sure. Yeah. Well. I was in a small town, I had a great advantage because of my mother's death and being the oldest at home, and because I had to take care of kids, I got a car. And my dad was traveling all the time. I was 16, when the time I was 16, I had a car, and right away, I was somebody special because, yes, King of the Hill. I lived across the street from an empty field. In the center of the city, there was an empty field, and that was a baseball field. So there was the neighborhood gangs, of course, and there you had your neighborhood sweetheart, of course not, Ada Lucille Gumper was my first sweetheart, of course not. Saw her not too many years ago, still beautiful. She married a foreign career officer from the United States, traveled all over the world, beautiful girl. One of the reasons she was my sweetheart, because she lived around the corner. She also came from 9 children. And the whole family was musical and sang, and so did I. And we were in little musicals together. And I would have the lead, and she'd have the female lead, starting in grade school.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because we were, she was very good. She played 20 instruments, but I used to sing, and she would sing, and so naturally we had this love affair. And we had the usual things that high school kids would have. There was the dances, and picnics were a big thing. There's all kinds of picnics, and you belonged to clubs. I was the first Jew to be member of the High Y. There was no YMHA.
There was no community center.
There was no community center, so, and you were only supposed to be, if you believed in Christ, could you belong to the YMCA, you see, so. We didn't believe in Christ, so they really had to be special treatment to get us into these clubs. Exactly.
Interesting. From small towns, you're very aware of that. From the big city.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're aware of what it is to be Jew. You're asking what it was. I wanted to belong to that club. All my friends belonged to that club. And yet I couldn't belong because I couldn't tell them that I believed in Jesus.
And that was one of the requisites.
You had to be Christian. Christian meant that you believed in Jesus. So, eventually friends of mine liked me and said, hey, going to get you in. And they got me in. You know, they didn't ask any questions. They just got you in. And they risked themselves. You know, they, you know, there were plenty of people who didn't like Jews. We were very aware in a small town where when the main street was, at that particular time, was half the merchants were Jewish, the shoe stores, the dress shops, and the men's stores, you know. And view of the community was that anybody who had a store on Main Street automatically must be rich. And rich Jews, the two things went together, the same word. The bankers were Gentile stronghold. There were no Jews in the bank, not even tellers. I mean, if they were we had a Jew working in the post office. That was a big deal already. There was a country club. I was not really aware of the country club until I got to maybe advanced high school years. And no, I don't think kids participated in the country clubs at that point the way. It was an adult place, really. You know, it wasn't some place for kids. Tennis and wasn't really popular at that point to the extent it later became. And country club was an issue later when I lived there as an adult. Then it became an issue. And a big issue.
Where did you go
swimming? The park. The Alameda Park. There was one park. There was a, you had a streetcars, and the streetcar company owned the park. You know, like Idlewild, yeah. Like, I don't know what they call those places. And they had the dance hall there, and the roller skating was there. It was all in one place, and that was it. And they were all fire traps, too. They're all wood. Yeah. And the streetcar went down to that. Even in the summer, they put the open streetcars for the summer. And, you know, so they weren't closed in. So we used to go down to the park. That's the only place that you would. It was the only place. You either swam at the Y, and you couldn't swim at the Y because you weren't Jew, you weren't Christian, or you could swim at the park. And then you could only swim in the summertime. The other place you could go was Slippery Rock Creek. Okay? And they had Etna Springs. That was all summertime. So those are the places you went. And you went for a picnic, and then you went swimming. And that's how you went. But you didn't go swimming like you do now. You go every day if you want to. It wasn't convenient. And nobody had private pools. There were no private pools. That didn't exist. You know, indoor pools and so forth. And you, when you went to high school, of course, then they had a swimming pool in the high school. And so you took swimming there, part of the requirement of your physical education. I feel like I'm going from some ancient times to, yet really in my lifetime so much, in our lifetime so much has happened. Radio, television.
Wait, I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm thinking to myself, if anybody didn't know this man, they would think he was a real old man.
Yeah.
Like our kids used to say to us, in olden times.
Yeah.
You know, in olden times.
What did you do?
That's true. But the pace of what happened, you know, from my dad on a horse, you know, it's amazing.
It's almost unbelievable.
It's almost unbelievable.
How did this all work for your benefit when you went to Penn State?
I don't know that it worked to my benefit, particularly when I went to Penn State. I think that that the education in the city was probably better. They offered a variety of courses, and I think it was city education was probably better. It was probably a disadvantage coming from a small town where, if it weren't for the fact that I was a good student and one of the better students, I would have thought it was a disadvantage. I don't see an advantage at all.
In other words, you didn't feel that living in a small town, and did you not feel very secure about yourself in a small town?
Not particularly, no. I mean, I was one of a very obvious minority. The people who wanted to be cruel to me would remind me that I was, remind you of Jewish. I don't know how it was with girls, but boys certainly would remind you, you know, you're Jewish and you're rich and you're a kike and whatever else they could think of. When those who wanted to make life miserable for you, those who were friends,
well,
of course.
Well, that you find in a big town or
small. Yes,
really.
But there's a lot of it in a small town. And in those times, there was a lot of ethnicity. There was a Polish, because of the steel mills, a tremendous Polish and Russian population who carried with them a lot of anti-Semitism to right from their homes. You know, they brought it with them from Europe. I don't think it was any advantage. As far as Penn State is concerned, living in a small town.
Did you enjoy your years at State?
Loved them. Happy years. Care. The only carefree time of my life.
Really?
I was no longer at home. My father remarried. Only had to worry about one person, me. And it was a happy environment. I had met a lot of wonderful...
They don't call it Happy Valley for nothing.
No, you know. And I would call it happy years. I think the only cloud on the horizon was that those of us who were serious, I include myself amongst those, knew that things in the world were bad. We were very much, we had silver shirts in Butler. We had silver shirt meetings in Butler.
That was a hotbed, if I recall
correctly,
of silver shirts.
Right. Brown shirts, silver shirts. They had meetings and tent meetings. I went to them just to hear sometimes, just to see. And
I think if
you
would elaborate on that a little bit, that could be very interesting, because I don't know how many people have had that experience.
Yeah.
Very few.
Very few.
And it's a very frightening thing.
Very frightening.
And I know that they mobilized the few Jewish people, Jewish men in communities to be aware of this.
Sure. I was not a man at that time. I was, you know, a high school kid, but I was aware of being Jewish. I was aware of anti-Semitism. I was aware of Nazism. You know, I came from a household where we were well informed of what was going on in the world. And the Hearst papers were existing then, the Pittsburgh Sun-Telegraph. My father always used to say that he didn't like to read the Sun-Telegraph. He'd rather read PM. Remember the paper PM? None of you remember PM. The fellow who ran PM just died the other day, a fellow named Ingersoll. It was owned by Marshall Fields eventually, but Ingersoll started the paper. It was a very liberal paper. And that paper would, you know, tell you about the wonderful things about Jews and other people. And but he would say, if I read, I don't like to read the PM. The reason I don't like to read PM because they tell the truth of what's happening in the world. I'd rather read the Sun-Telegraph because there I read that the Jews control the world. And he said, I'd love to read that. And he said, that makes me feel better. We run the world. And so, yeah, we were aware of the... So when the Silver Shirts did come to Butler, they'd set up their tent meetings.
Would you explain to us exactly what the Silver Shirts were?
They were just nothing more than Nazis here in America. They were people who were... many of them were of German origin. Many of them were bought into the Nazi theories totally, and I think they were financed essentially by from splinter groups from Germany, and they came in and actually it just sounded like Hitler speaking himself. You know, the whole story: what the Jews are rich, the Jews control the world. If we get rid of the Jews, everything will be fine. We'll get rid of the Depression. The reason he got a depression is because the bankers are all Jewish. There's the Rothschilds and the Morgenthaus, and they list all these names, and those are the people who run the world. The New York Times is run by Jews, you know, the Salzburgers and so on. And that's what you would hear. And the best thing to do is get rid of the Jews you have in this town.
Did that cause trouble?
I don't think that it caused any trouble in particular. It made life miserable for us. You know, you were on edge all the time. You didn't realize. You wondered how many people believed this. You never really knew.
Is that Look, at the beginning of the neighbor's anti-defamation.
Well, I'm not sure it was the beginning. I think that was already existing. I think the ADL goes back farther than that. Sure. Sure. Those, the EAJC, all these organizations started to respond. There needed to be the Jewish community wasn't organized to the extent that we are today, and particularly in a small town. So it was left to people like my father, who was a real orator anyway, and he would go to these things, and you know, he'd fight back. He wasn't afraid.
He was a fearless man.
He was a fearless man. He was, as a matter of fact, he was president of the Tri-State Zionist region. He was president of the, from Butler, he was president of the B'nai B'rith, Tri-State B'nai B'rith. So he was a very dynamic pepper pot of a man, and he'd take on anybody, verbally anyway.
He apparently had the respect of his
yeah,
peers.
Yeah, he did. He was well-informed, and he wasn't afraid, and he was, you know, he always, his biggest argument was with Jews who tried to say, let's be a little quiet about it. Yeah, sha, sha, sha. You know, he was a fighter. I'm not the fighter he was, but he was a fighter.
Did you go into service from, from Penn State?
Matter of fact, I was, graduation was June of 42. I was in ROTC, my birthday's May 7th, and I was sworn in Princeton, New Jersey on May 7th because I was 21 and thou could become an officer. You had to be 21 to be an officer. So I was 21 years old, and I went into the service at once.
Where did
they ship
you, Sam, to tell us a little bit about your
own? Well, I was an infantry officer. Weighed 117 pounds. They had to wave, weighed 120. They had to wave, in order to become an officer, I had to weigh 125. I didn't weigh 125, I weighed 120 pounds, so they had to wave. They had to wave 5 pounds, and my commission shows a waiver of weight.
You were in ROTC at
yep.
Penn State. Mm-hmm. That's why you
yeah. That's right, that's why I went as lieutenant. And then I was sent to, I think I went to the Carlisle Barracks, and then I was assigned to an infantry unit, the 26th Division. And I went to South Carolina. You don't want to do my whole Army career.
No, only significant things that, you know, directed your life in certain ways.
Well, wherever I went in the Army, I was very active in the Jewish aspect of it, such as being a chazan and a cantor. I used to conduct services.
You did that also in college, did you not?
I did that. Hello.
Yes, I think. See, I think that is something that people
yeah.
really want to know about.
Oh well, I did it not only in college for Hillel, but I did it for Rockview State Penitentiary.
The
state pen is 8 miles from Penn State. That's what I always used to say it. Well, the rabbi who was in charge of Hillel the last couple of years I was there was Ben Kahn, who later became national director of Hillel. And he, the Hillel director at Penn State, also served as the chaplain for the Rockview State Penitentiary because it was only 8 miles away. And by state law, the three major religions had to provide religious services and so on for the prisoners. And he would not travel on the Shabbat, so he asked me to be the rabbi out there for the last couple of years that I was at Penn State. So I used to go out every Saturday to Rockview State Penitentiary for the
what
state.
What were the three major religions?
Catholicism, Protestantism, and Judaism.
Okay.
So
we were included. Were there
okay.
Jewish prisoners?
Yes. There were about, that time, these were mostly crimes of violence at Rockview State Penitentiary. The federal prisoners in Lewisburg, that's crimes of the brain, embezzlement, and so on. So there was, but there's the crimes of violence, murder, theft, robbery and so forth. And that's what the prisoners there were. And so the first time I went there, well, there are about 12 or 1,300 prisoners, if I recall correctly, at Rockview State Penitentiary. And there were about 7 or 8 Jewish prisoners in there at the time, not enough to make a minyan. And they, as a matter of fact, when I went there the first time, one of the prisoners who knew my father, who had been a salesman on the road, he said, "Are you from Butler?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Oh, Baxter, yes." He said, "I used to sell your father." He'd been a salesman at one point in his life. And they were telling me that that we Jews have very little to be ashamed of in this prison. There's only 7 or 8 of us.